when the main drama for the global South was pushing out the Europeans, there was a lot of concerns about the rights, you know, human rights, rights of groups. You know, if as long as these rights could be used as a weapon against their oppressors, they were more likely to have affinity with the Palestinians who were using the same sorts of weapons. Now that the tools that the Palestinians are using, international law, international humanitarian norms, are inconvenient for some of these post-colonial territories, we're beginning to see a shift.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
So as you may have heard, everything's gone terrible in Israel and Palestine at the moment. Would you like to fill us in, Rob?
I'm not sure if I can provide many more details on what's happening recently than others have already heard. Just briefly, Israel has experienced an attack far more severe than any of they've experienced since they actually had military rivals back in the 1970s. I think the current numbers are that 1,200 people are dead. While I and this channel are, you know, tend to be very sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause, we're in a moment where the Israelis really have experienced a trauma that has to be acknowledged here, not just because it's going to result in, presumably, not as of yet as of this recording, but presumably much larger crimes committed against the Gazans, but also just out of common humanity. What the Israelis are going through, what Jews all over the world are going through, seeing these images, and is worth acknowledging and not minimizing in any way. People have been sort of throwing around the comparison that this is Israel's 9/11, and frankly, I think that's actually entirely incorrect because it is much, much worse for Israel than 9/11 was. If you just think in terms of the population of Israel, sort of a mere 10 to 15 million, this is depending on how you count the subject Palestinian population, in comparison to the 330-odd million Americans, this would be the equivalent of a 9/11 where 30,000 people were killed rather than 3,000. And also the intimacy and the savagery of what was done to primarily civilians. The Yom Kippur War back in 1973, for the next 3 days, probably not by the time of this recording, depending on whether or not Israel goes into Gaza, had a body count that was higher, barely from where we are right now, for Israelis, but those were mostly soldiers. This is children, this is families, this is quite horrific. The United States was never in the dream of anybody under any threat because of 9/11. It mostly just unleashed us to make a horrific series of mistakes and really to consolidate U.S. empire. It was not any serious threat. I actually do not believe that Israel is under any serious threat to its existence at this point. I think there's certainly a serious threat to the existence of the Netanyahu government that has extraordinarily failed in its duty to protect the Israeli citizens. But I don't think anybody really disputes that Israel is safe in this moment. But that's not how it feels to the Israeli population that has become quite accustomed to decades of complacency and, it's so, so horrible that somebody got hit with a Hamas rocket and, you know, we only killed 100 Palestinians in return. This is very different, and that needs to be acknowledged. As far as speaking in this podcast about the details of the attack and or the Israeli response, which is already incredibly savage. Let's be clear about that. They are pancaking apartment buildings.
And they've said they're going to stop doing the knock-knock technique? Have you heard of this?
Oh, where they warn people first?
Yeah, they have a specific type of explosive that creates a lot of noise, but generally doesn't destroy the building, and you have 30 seconds to get out. and then they'll hit with a real one. Kind of reminds me of the provisional IRA. It used to give like bomb warnings to hotels, so it's a weird sort of modern version of that.
And it, I think it's, I mean, obviously, any chance that higher chance that people have to survive is a good thing. But I think the idea that that was some kind of great humanitarian choice on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces is, I think, already an obscenity. The fact that they're doing away with those fig leaves is horrific. There's no question that the Israeli government is already committing war crimes in Gaza. The full-on siege of Gaza. I mean, Gaza has never been an independent, or at least not since the 1960s, has not been an independent entity in any way. People who try to portray it in that way, just because the settlers left in 2005, are delusional. And the Israeli government has cut off all electricity, water, and food shipments to Gaza.
And one horrible statistic is about half of the population are under 18.
Yes.
So there will be a hell of a lot of children suffering because of the water and electric being cut off.
So I would never want to minimize the crimes that have been committed against Israel in this instance. They are, as someone who's frequently belabored the point that there's no proportionality here, and that, you know, Israelis are killing at least dozens in return for one. I mean, that's not the case here. Israel has suffered an incredible loss.
Absolutely.
But the Israeli government is already committing war crimes. This is the retaliation against civilians is immense. The bombing, the intensity and brutality of the bombing, as we've already discussed, is already extreme. And this is promised by the Israeli government to be merely the start. And by the time you are hearing this, we're recording this on Thursday, meant to be uploaded on Monday, the chances of the actual Israeli ground invasion of Gaza having started are pretty high, and that will just take things another order of magnitude of savagery up. But we can't really speak to much of this. It's, you know, this will not be current by the time you hear it. So I thought it might be worthwhile to step back and talk in broader strokes about sort of Israel, Palestine, and time. Time has traditionally been seen as a weapon for the Palestinians. As you mentioned, Gaza is nearly half children. I think a sort of traditional meme or thought about this conflict is that the Palestinians are just going to breed the Israelis out. It's impossible for them to maintain, and I think we've learned pretty conclusively that that's not the case. Israel has the most power in this relationship by orders and orders and orders of magnitude, and has plenty of levers to pull so that whatever demographic advantage that is actually looking a little slimmer. I think fertility in Gaza is through the roof. I'm not so certain about West Bank or Israeli Arabs, and the rise of Jewish religious orthodoxy in Israeli politics and Israeli society is also leading to a demographic push as well. So I think that traditional supposed victory for the Palestinians isn't going to happen. And I think what's less talked about is the staying power and the importance of every year that goes by with Israel establishing itself more and more, the dream of some kind of post-colonial ejection of Israel becomes further and further and further away. And to be clear, I'm okay with that. I believe in the state of Israel. I believe there's a reason for it to exist. And I know that will make some of my audience unhappy, but that's just the way it is. So I want to talk about history here, but sort of in a different way. I've spoken a lot, well, more than I care to, about Israel and Palestine over the years. I know many wish that I would speak more about it, but I don't speak more about it because it's frankly too depressing. I think that the crimes that have been committed against the Palestinians and that will be committed against the Palestinians are so immense that it's not a country that it's possible to be, Israel and Palestine, it's not a relationship or a country that it's possible to be hopeful about. I joke, but it's not really a joke, that I prefer to focus on like more optimistic seeming countries like Afghanistan or Sudan or Somalia. It is not a happy future I see for Israel-Palestine. I ran a sort of two-hour live chat that was linked in the description of this past week's two-hour live chat on Israel-Palestine that has more of the details of the current fracas, if you want to get into it. But just talking about, like, this is how incredibly depressing I see it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And unfortunately, that depressing vision that I laid out has been pretty enthusiastically confirmed over the past week or so. So today I want to talk about history and then just the broader international stance of positioning of Israel and Palestine. I think that Palestinian supporters, certainly the Palestinian governments and the Palestinian leadership are relying on a world climate of opinion, a set of beliefs and views about the conflict that may be fading away. Time is not having the inexorable pressure towards Palestinian victory that most were hoping, and in fact, many in the world were hoping, and it looks to me as though, despite its ruinous, utterly bankrupt and horrific leadership over the past couple decades, Israel's looking pretty solid to me, and looking more solid with every year that passes. That's what I would like to talk about today.
So are we going to go as far back as the Ottoman Empire?
I don't think that's going to be entirely necessary, though certainly if you want to talk about the genesis of the Israeli state, the sort of Zionist project, then you do have to go back to the Ottoman Empire. And fundamentally, I guess it's saying some very controversial things about what Israel absolutely is. I think for the Israel supporters who are listening here, you may be outraged by this, but let me complete what I'm saying here, because I think it'll outline some realities about, first and foremost, U.S. support for Israel that a lot of folks in the world don't completely understand, I think. Israel is an apartheid state. There's no question about that. If you dispute that, you simply don't know the definition of apartheid and are insufficiently familiar with the South African example that sort of inspired that as an international law concept. It is a settler colonial state. It is a state put together primarily by European migrants in land that was seen as open or theirs for some reason. This isn't controversial. This is just historical fact. It is fascinating, and I think this is a very new development, but I think it's actually an interesting sort of hyper-nationalist usage of woke terminology, which sounds kind of confusing here. I think it's only since 2020, really. And I think the sort of Black Lives Matter movement and then the focus on color lines and discrimination and racism in the Western world primarily, but in other places, that this became a talking point. But it's now a standard talking point for Israel supporters, even for folks who are not like super rabid Israel supporters and will acknowledge that crimes are being committed against the Palestinians. I saw TikTok recently as this idea that the Jews are indigenous to Israel. It is an indigenous resistance movement. It is, should not be seen as European settler colonialism. This is really like indigenous Jewish territory. It's been that way for thousands of years, and that is just nonsense. That is historically ignorant. It is a figment. What this relies upon is the population of, I believe, Mizrahi Jews, I believe is the term, which there are absolutely, I should have looked this up beforehand, I don't know if it's 30-40% of the population of Israel is made up of Jews that were indigenous to the Middle East. That is absolutely true.
Seems to be a 2016 study suggests 45% of Israel's Jewish population were Mizrahi. Is that how you pronounce it?
I always thought it was Mizrahi, but I'm sure I've gotten it entirely wrong. The thing is, though, like indigenous to the Middle East. So that means these are Jews that were kicked out of Morocco 50 years ago, that were kicked out of Algeria. It's like saying that the entire nation of Spain or the entire nation of Turkey is indigenous to Israel, which would be fundamentally ridiculous. So that's an absurdity, frankly, and is entirely a part of the failing effort to placate liberal leaning American Jews. It is an absurdity, especially when you consider that that Mizrahi population, I believe, I looked this up one time, and out of all of the presidents, which are, is more of a ceremonial position in Israel, and all of the prime ministers, there were maybe two presidents, this is the ceremonial position, that had were of Mizrahi descent. Of the prime ministers, the people who actually run the country, most almost all of them in Israeli and in Israeli history came from like Belarus or Wisconsin. So you've got that 45% that are of Mizrahi descent, which basically means they're not from Europe, which means they're from Iran or they're from Morocco or they're from a number of other places. And of course, the Israelis are interested in goosing those numbers as much as possible for the propaganda victory of saying, like, oh, no, it's Jews from the Middle East. But if you look at who's run the country for the entirety of Israel's existence, it's guys. I mean, isn't Netanyahu from Philadelphia or something? Like, it's guys.
He does. He does have like an American accent to me.
It's mostly people from Belarus or Wisconsin that have run Israel. And my understanding from Jewish Americans who've lived there is that the sort of it's much like the United States, like the sort of racial. Hierarchy there is pretty pretty intense. Settler colonial aspects of Israel, however, I am not someone who is hypocritical enough to condemn that. I live in a settler colonial country, the United States of America, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. These are successful examples of settler colonial entities. There are many, many examples of unsuccessful settler colonial entities, and part of the reason why the Global South, why all of the countries that experienced the intensity of colonization from in the 19th and 20th centuries, and the joy, the vigor of being part of independence movements towards the middle and end of the 20th century, have always had this affinity with the Palestinians because there were many, many settler colonial projects, specifically in Africa, lasting until I was alive. Lasting, I believe, Rhodesia finally gave in to, you know, became Zimbabwe in like 1980. I was born in 1979. You had South Africa, which was absolutely a settler colonial society, the epitome thereof, that lasted as a white supremacist state until, I believe, 1992. That is the context within which the majority of the world has understood Israel-Palestine, or certainly was how it was understood in the 20th century. So Israel is in this strange in-between thing. There were places like Algeria, like the Portuguese colonies in Africa, like Rhodesia, South Africa, that failed. There was Kenya, actually, was a full-on United Kingdom attempt at creating a white settler overclass against the indigenous Kenyans. There was a lot of this in the mid-20th century, and I don't think anybody would have been outraged or surprised to see the Israel-Palestine project as part of that. The fact is that Israel has survived, and I think it is likely to survive. And the reason I want to title this podcast is Israel, Palestine, and Time, is that the time is incredibly important. This effort, this Israeli effort has already lasted, depending on whether you want to talk from 1917 and the Balfour Declaration, when the British sort of opened the floodgates for Jewish migration to Israel, or if you want to start from 1948, this is an experiment that has already lasted a century. Algeria, which was probably one of the strongest and most brutally defeated of the European projects, that started sort of in 1830 and was over by 1962. So we're already, the Israeli project has already lasted much longer than, certainly much longer than any of those British examples, Rhodesia, South Africa, and it looks a lot more vigorous than those projects did. So I think it's actually likely to survive. The thing is that the more time that passes, that question of who is indigenous to Israel or who is not gets more complex. I don't know what the anthropological definition of what indigenous is or is not, but the simple fact is that with time, and especially from the U.S. perspective, and the U.S. perspective is the one that matters the most, the more time that Israel exists, the more legitimacy is added to it, the more that the question of whether or not a certain person's ancestors came from Europe or the Middle East means less and less. The fact is that there are European-descended Israelis who have been in Israel for the majority. Their families have been there for 80 years at this point. Some of them have been there for 100 years. Some of them have been for as many as 120 years. 3, 4, 5, 6 generations. Does it really matter whether or not they are indigenous for the purposes of these people, these families, and all of their relevant family history? It's been in Israel. Israel is a fact that exists and can simply not be wiped away or population transitioned away. It is something that exists, and with every year that goes by, that truth becomes more and more apparent. I've talked before how I have very little interest in questions of thousands of years ago or this, that, and the other thing. I am from the United States. I live on land that has been taken. I do believe that my great-great-great-great-grandparents committed incredible crimes to take this land. Israel is not as old as the United States, is not land that was taken as far in the past as Manhattan Island, which I'm recording this in today. But the fact is that enough time has passed that it's these crimes are not as present as the Palestinians would like them to be. They're not as capable of full rectification as the Palestinians would like them to be. And with every year that passes, every decade that passes, that becomes more and more the case. That is in the nature of settler colonial entities. And we've certainly seen that in the United States, which is another example of the affinity that the United States has with Israel. The sort of catch-22 at the heart of Israel and its great tragedy is that it is still a settler colonial project that I believe is likely to be successful. That's at the state that, say, the United States was in, between the 1790s or like the 1860s or something along those lines. It's not an accomplished project. The incredible need for an Israeli state was, well, apparent to many for decades before the Holocaust, but was created by the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, certainly, debatably, actually, it actually took, depending on who you ask, it took 10, 20 years for the United States to get fully on board with this idea and for Europe to get fully on board with this idea. But the much of the Western world and certainly Jews across the world became utterly convinced of the need for a Jewish state because of the Holocaust. What's fascinating about this is that another result of the Holocaust is the birth of a world community that gives a shit about human rights. So it is the Holocaust that made the necessity for Israel look so vital and so important, yet it is the Holocaust that made their project of disowning and brutalizing the Palestinians seem unacceptable. So it's a fascinating contradiction that Israel has had to deal with. And it is, if Israel was trying to do what it's doing now, at any point before 1945, before this sort of broader idea of a world community with the United Nations and universal ideas of human rights, had they been attempting to do that at any point before that, there would be no questions. And if you look at, I haven't done a lot of work on the primary documents, but my read on some things I've read is it's quite explicit from the 1880s up until the 1930s, like what the Jews intend to do in Palestine. And they're quite open about, like, we are settlers. It's only after 1945, at the exact point that it becomes vitally important to many people in the world that there be an Israeli state, this new layer of complexity and squeamishness about colonial projects that comes from the same source, which is just a fascinating catch-22 at the heart of the Israeli project. And for years, Palestinians were able to rely on this new awareness in the West, but also a really, really high degree of solidarity from Africa, Latin America, Asia, and other, there are other continents, right? You know, there's Australians who were supportive of Palestine, though they did not have such a...
Okay, and the odd ones in Europe.
Yeah, indeed. I believe that that world is fading away. And I think that's probably the most important message I want to convey today. I think that...
Are people becoming less empathetic with Palestine? Is it just because it's gone on so long, or is it purely because of the recent events that have taken place being so barbaric?
I think that there's been always been a tension between support for Palestine and the squeamishness about some of the tactics adopted, I think largely out of desperation by some small groups of Palestinians. This is a game changer in a lot of ways, the severity of this particular attack, but I don't think it's like a new, like changing everything thing. What I'm talking about is a broader dynamic related to the passage of time and really like the end of the directly post-colonial world. If you're on a U.S. college campus, we're living in post-colonial forever. That's all that matters is, you know, we've got to, you know, talk about colonization, and, you know, the evils of white people, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's certainly some scope for that. I think that as an analytical framework, I think it makes a lot of sense. But as the post-independence countries are developing decades and now a half century, importantly, places like India, I mean, we're coming up on 80 years now of independence, these countries are developing in ways that make them less reflexively sympathetic towards the Palestinians. It's frankly people dying, Ruri. I think a really fascinating thing I thought was just the leader of the West Bank is Mahmoud Abbas, I believe his name is. He's 87 years old. I mean, this is a guy who lived most of his life in the 20th century. And is familiar with a different way of looking at things. The guy in charge of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is 61, but still very much a sort of 20th century guy. And I think that certainly to a greater extent with Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority that controls the West Bank, there's an expectation of sort of reflexive sympathy from the developing world, from the global South that I think is frankly disappearing. It's the passage of time, Ruri, that makes mm-hmm. the most difference. The decades that have gone by since post-colonialism, I mean, I think 1992 is probably the point to look at with the fall of apartheid South Africa is sort of the point at which the actual decolonization process of formal independence for these countries that had been under European domination, that's sort of when that happened. And certainly for decades thereafter, a lot of the people in power, and this is still the case in most of the world, had very clear memories of that decolonization process, very clear ideological affiliations, events that were very clearly relevant to them, formed them. That will be the case for decades to come, but in a lot of cases, those generations of leaders are dying. One great example would be Nelson Mandela. I mean, everybody still knows who Nelson Mandela was, the incredible freedom fighter, the who was imprisoned by South Africa for decades, emerged from prison, and extraordinarily not only took control of his country, but managed to do so from a place of reconciliation and peace. I mean, he's the closest thing possible to a secular saint that you can imagine. But there were large sections of, not large sections, but significant sections of in Washington, D.C. politics and Washington in U.S. politics that absolutely loathed him for, or rather loathed this particular action, because he always had great affinity with Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian cause, because he identified that as being part of the same struggle. Nelson Mandela, of course, is long gone. As the succeeding generations of leaders face the problems of not of fighting for independence, not of fighting against the traditional European colonizer, but the details of running a country, they're just getting more and more distant from this affinity with the Palestinians, and that is part of the accumulating time that works in Israel's favor. This dynamic is important for all independent countries, including those who have really...
great relationships.
Well, those who have great relationships with the majority of their own publics. You're seeing a more accelerated version of this with post-colonial countries, which is probably a majority of them, that have some kind of problem with their own ethnic minorities. So in the context of still struggling, when the main drama into the 1980s, when the main drama for the global South was pushing out the Europeans, there was a lot of concerns about the rights, you know, human rights, rights of groups. If as long as these rights could be used as a weapon against their oppressors, they were more likely to have affinity with the Palestinians, who were using the same sorts of weapons. Now that the tools of the weapons that the Palestinians are using, international law, international humanitarian norms, are inconvenient for some of these post-colonial territories, we're beginning to see a shift. It's not happening quickly, but as someone who's paid fairly close attention to these events for the past 20 years, it is very, very clear. Possibly the most significant of all these, the most stunning thing that anybody can look up would be Narendra Modi's reaction to these attacks in Israel. He has been filled with solidarity for Israel. No mention of any kind of restraint. It's just, we stand with, India stands with Israel, whatever they need to do, wholehearted. It's kind of extraordinary that really Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken, the United States, has talked more about Israeli restraint and Israel needing to observe the rules of war than India has. And that's such an extraordinary shift. I mean, that's if you wanted to point to one thing, that's sort of the proof of what I'm talking about today. That is sort of the death of the post-colonial world, the death of the 20th century. I was reading an article this morning. India didn't have diplomatic relations with Israel until the 1990s. Because it was so clearly in Indian politics, intellectual life, it was so clear that the Israeli state was a legacy of British imperialism, was European imperialism, and their solidarity with the Palestinians was just rock solid. This was already falling apart. You know, relations were open in the 1990s. India is very concerned to develop its own military-industrial complex. Israel is first and foremost a paid-up subsidiary of the U.S. military-industrial complex in its government and its economy. There's obviously much more to the Jewish homeland than that, but as far as the way their government works and the way their economy works, it's a military-industrial complex thing. So relations increased between India and Israel during the Congress Party's time in power. Quietly and subtly. And of course, whenever a flare-up happened between the Israel and Palestine, India would still talk about its traditional solidarities. And of course, we you know, regret all loss of life, but Israel must end the occupation, blah, blah, blah. With Modi, that's over.
Isn't India trying to make their own, like, Belt and Road that involves Israel?
I wouldn't be surprised. India is, I'm not familiar with the details of that, but India is incredibly interested A very important thing, I think I made up a video about this recently, a very important thing that Israel has been very careful to do over the past 30 years as it's become more and more of a technology and military technology and espionage and cyber hub, is cultivate its relationship with the plausible new hegemons. It's worked very closely and sold a lot of technology to both China and India. So that's a really key dynamic. And yes, India is very interested in... are you thinking about there's some absurd hogwash about they're going to build, they're going to use Israeli ports, and they're going to build like a railway across Saudi Arabia or something. And it's like in...
Yes, that's the very one.
Yeah, I mean, it is...
Then it will link up with Greece and then from there to the EU.
That could totally happen. But the... I mean, this is back to the idiocy of Halford Mackinder, that guy who's like, all that matters is the world island. And his fundamental misunderstanding was the assumption that at some point rail traffic would become cheaper than sea traffic. Well, 120 years later, that emphatically has not happened. And the idea that it makes any kind of sense or would be in any way more secure to put together some kind of haphazard rail network across the Gulf kingdoms and then Saudi Arabia and then, what, Jordan and then Israel, it is extraordinarily absurd, but the U.S. government and the Saudi government are behind it. That's another indication of just how far India has fallen away from any kind of solidarity with the Palestinians, that they would even entertain this idea that is essentially just a money-sucking MacGuffin designed to further legitimize Israel.
But has Palestine fallen out more so with neighboring countries like Egypt, that at one stage would have provided a lot more help?
Egypt in 1979, in return for the return of the Sinai Peninsula, signed a deal with Israel, and they've been given billions of dollars by the United States every year since because of that. Jordan, in I believe the 90s, I'm not as familiar with the details of the normalization, normalized ties with Israel. So what the Palestinians could rely on from the 1940s until the 1970s, and then the 1990s was essentially gone. Syria is sort of the lone holdout that certainly played a role in why the U.S. destroyed it in 2011 and thereafter.
And a bit of Lebanon,
yes. Lebanon is an incredibly fraught place. It's another country that I was like, I put a lot of time and effort into researching Lebanon a year or two back, and I'm glad I did. It's fascinating. It's really important for the broader understanding of the region, but I like to make videos that at least have some positive suggestion or like a prospect of upward movement, and I could see none in Lebanon. Lebanon is not entirely run by Hezbollah, but Hezbollah is probably the most powerful actor in Lebanon, though it also has to worry about what the Lebanese public wants, what the Christian populations want, what the Sunni populations want. It's a nightmare.
And its economic prospects are not looking promising.
In the politics of the region, generally, I've been very sniffy about the Abraham Accords because they're deals that are made with, that Israel is making with fundamentally illegitimate actors. The disgusting medieval petro princes of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. I don't believe Saudi Arabia is going to be around in a decade. Actually signing a deal with those guys would probably be a detriment to Israel. Saudi has not signed a deal yet, but that's certainly what people were hoping for before this set of attacks. But the four countries that have, Bahrain, Sudan, UAE and Morocco, really only one of those deals I think is worth the paper that it's written on. Morocco, and this is a key aspect of what I'm talking about. Morocco still has a public that's really invested in solidarity with the Palestinians, rage towards Israel. Morocco is very much an absolute monarchy, but nowhere near to the extent of the Gulf countries. There is some give and take with the public. There is a legislature. There is a series of elections that the king has to worry about. what Morocco was able to pull off. Oh, yeah, sorry. So Sudan. So we've got 25% of the countries that signed Abraham Accords no longer exist. Sudan is in the midst of a horrific civil war. Bahrain is a joke. It's not a it is a Saudi occupied country essentially, and the UAE is unserious for a range of reasons. Morocco's a real country. Morocco's a real country with a real public that has to be satisfied to some degree, a real government, and it signed a deal with Israel to the rage of, no doubt, of generations of Moroccans. But they were able to do this because they got something in return. And that's the key detail here. And it becomes is very important for India. The idea of solidarity with the Palestinians becomes less attractive when you've got your own population that you want to repress. What Morocco got in return for signing this accord with Israel that was satisfying, I believe, to a degree to the Moroccan public was international acknowledgement of Moroccan annexation of some territory they took back in the 1970s, specifically Western Sahara. And the U.S. said, okay, that's okay. And that was a incredible victory for Morocco that the king could go to the Moroccan public with. Not that, again, it's still an absolute monarchy, it's mostly absolute monarchy, but he could justify what he'd done because he had also racked up a huge win for Morocco. And that's the dynamic, that's the key of the most significant.
It's all about making deals.
Yeah, and that's the key. That's the most significant aspect of India's sort of abandonment of Palestine, and that is the fact that India's got a large Muslim population that the current government doesn't like much. This sort of global South put upon solidarity with Palestine seems to mean a lot less, especially when Palestine is committing atrocities that can be hung around. Sorry, some Palestinians are committing atrocities that can be hung around the head of India's own Muslim population and be used to demonize them. And that's like, you see this over and over and over again. Turkey, quite vehemently, as part of its Islamist push in the 2000s and the early 2010s, because at the same time, that Islamist push was working very hard towards peace with the Kurds. In the country. And as part of that solidarity, they worked very hard to capitalize on very real, not Arab, but Muslim solidarity with Palestine in the Turkish public to create a series of incidents between Erdogan and Netanyahu specifically. Since 2015, the Kurdish question in Turkey has become much more open and violent again. So Erdogan is reverting to the sort of the foreign policy choice of his erstwhile secular rivals of bonding with Israel over repressing a population. This is what happens. And Turkey, to be clear, was never, I would argue, was never really fully colonized the way most other countries were. But it certainly has some fraught relations with Europe, to put it lightly. And that's like, you can go down, I mean, so many countries have these concerns. Sri Lanka, is a country that is very traditionally has a lot of solidarity with Palestine, but the Sinhalese, I believe majority spent a while repressing the Tamils, you know, and it just, a surprising number of countries that Palestine used to look upon as their natural allies. Are facing the challenges of independence running their own countries, and because of that, are falling away from sympathy with Palestine.
Do you see any chance like Hezbollah would get involved, or are they just going to look scary at the border and have the odd skirmish?
I see a very strong possibility that Hezbollah could get involved. That's the huge question. As of this Thursday, recording Thursday, it'll be up on Monday, there's absolutely been shots fired between Israel and Hezbollah. But there is a certain balance of terror, a certain deterrence that has existed between Israel and Hezbollah since 2006. Yes, some rockets can go back and forth. Some militants can cross the border. But it's very small scale. And usually when a militant from Lebanon crosses the border, not usually, but often they'll be completely disallowed by Hezbollah, because neither Hezbollah nor Israel at this juncture wants to have a larger fight. And that was true even before Israel was contemplating going into Gaza at force in reaction to these recent attacks. It's been fascinating to watch the way that the United States and Israel in this juncture, in the aftermath of these attacks, are really, really, really concerned to tell everybody that Iran and Hezbollah had nothing to do with the attacks, which is fascinating. Hezbollah and Iran, Hezbollah, by the way, is a militia in Lebanon that is, I think, according to Washington, D.C., everything that happens in the Middle East is a fault of sinister direction direct from Iran. That is not true. Hezbollah, however, is, to an extent that surprised me when I finally got down to researching them in depth a couple of years back, really is directly controlled by Iran. So if Hezbollah gets involved in a serious way, we're talking about war between Israel and Iran. We're talking about the U.S.'s next trillion-dollar Middle Eastern war. And I am terrified, worried, that that is a prospect. That is something that could have started by the time this recording is uploaded. But what's fascinating is watching how badly every actor is trying to avoid that, other than Hamas. There was a Wall Street article, Wall Street Journal article, that really embarrassed the Wall Street Journal, I believe. I think within a day or two of the attacks, I can't recall if it was Sunday or Monday, that said there are direct links between, you know, Hezbollah and Iran approved and helped plan this Hamas attack. And if that were true, if that were confirmed, if the U.S. government came out and said, yeah, that's what our intelligence indicates, like, that'd be it. Like, that'd be, we would be back into the war on, you know, we would be back into, like, invading Iraq times, except with a lot less money and a much more fraught international environment. A truly terrifying geopolitical development. The supreme leader of Iran came out and said, he, of course, would never condemn the Hamas attacks, but he came out and said, we had nothing to do with this. The U.S. government said in response to that Wall Street Journal article, we've seen no indication that this is the case. The Israeli government has come out to swear up and down that Iran had nothing to do with it.
Would that not be part of why it was such a surprise that there was so little people involved? Because if it was as international as Iran being involved, would it not trigger more intelligence agencies to rumble it?
Exactly. I think that's a key point that I saw someone else making on Twitter. It's a really... If Iran, I think the assumption is that Israel and the United States have so penetrated Iranian and Hezbollah networks that there's no way that something like this would have been happening, could have happened, if Iran and Hezbollah were as involved as the Wall Street Journal claims. So that is, I think that's a very key point. Hamas was able to organize this on this level. To be clear, absolutely with Iranian arms. I don't think anybody disputes that. And also arms stocked up, no doubt, over years, if not decades, by support from the whole Arab world as well. But it seems likely to me that a small core of folks were aware of what was being planned there, and they relied on the ability to have essentially a horde of young Gazan men to eagerly find out about it the night before and go hell for leather. A truly horrific attack that took a surprising amount of time for the Netanyahu government to crush.
Well, they think they deliberately picked a time when there has been a lot of divisions in Israel, and there were some people saying, oh, if, you know, something bad did happen, I wouldn't call up to the army. And there was pilots talking about striking, you know, and there was also a religious celebration. So obviously it's been, you know, meticulously timed to cause the most amount of damage, sadly.
And it has. And I think to some extent Hamas has gotten what it wanted so far. Absolutely part of Hamas's calculations are that as savage and horrific the cruelty of what they did was, Israel is almost guaranteed to retaliate in a vastly more extreme way.
Just to give a bit of context, Israel has claimed that it has dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza as of recording.
Jesus. And Gaza is essentially, it's all city. More or less.
I've heard some criticism. It's not quite, but it's a bit kind of like Manhattan. There's some parts that aren't as populated, but it's one of the most densely populated parts of the world.
Yeah, and they're not bombing the open fields in Gaza. They're bombing. Mm. So Hamas has sort of relied upon that, but I do feel that Hamas, less than the Palestinian Authority, which is mostly just hapless and not involved in this, mostly just dealing with stepped-up ethnic cleansing by the current Israeli government. But I do think they're relying on a different kind of world. I think they are the world that we lived in 2001, to a degree, where there's enough residual anger at the European colonies that it trumps the concern for stability and humanity of and the ability to persecute their own minorities of most of the global South. And I do wonder if their assumptions are off here. I think that they're most likely going, it's actually taken longer than I've expected, but they're most likely going to get this horrific Israeli ground invasion that is going to really turn international opinion against Israel again. But I don't see how you get from like A to B to C here. I don't see how that ends up as well as they'd like.
Is it possible that Israel, you know, retaliates in such a horrific manner that the world's appalled by, you know, what the outcome, and then flips solidarity more to Palestine?
But what is the world going to do? The only country that's really capable of international, international action would be the United States, and we're certainly never going to turn on Israel. Yeah, I mean, Hamas is just a pretty brutal, evil organization that I think did make an accurate calculation that the Palestinians were being forgotten. This whole Abraham Accords process, combined with Iran and Saudi Arabia also going for normalization, means that the whole premise of both the Trump and Biden administration's Middle East policies are, screw the Palestinians, we don't have to think about them anymore. Hamas has guaranteed that we're thinking about the Palestinians again. But I feel like they will be disappointed.
And doesn't Hamas only have about like 30% of the, you know, votes, but it manages to, because it's got that far, it's able to then to get 100% of the power?
Well, it,
so they're not even that popular, but yet they're going to cause horrendous misery.
Yeah, Hamas is a sort of one vote, one time situation. I believe it was in 2006 or 2007. There was an election. Hamas won, I believe, a majority in the Palestinian parliament. I investigate the minutiae, then fought a short war against the Palestinian Authority, their rivals that cooperate very closely with Israel and run the West Bank. And there hasn't been any kind of election or any kind of popular indication one way or the other how many people support Hamas since 2007, I think it was. So, yeah, we're talking 16 years ago. The Gazans are absolutely hostages to Hamas and its wishes and its policies. But let's never forget that, yeah, for about a week out of every decade, Hamas is the most evil, most destructive, most destabilizing actor in Israel-Palestine. And then for the other 9 years, 358 days, it's the Israeli government.
Because I think they don't really have, you know, free ports, essentially. They don't, although this region is along the coast, they don't really have access to the wider world from that. Everything is controlled by Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they don't really have an airport either.
Yeah, that was what the big tension was between Turkey and Israel. A bunch of Turkish activists tried to bring humanitarian aid and possibly some weapons.
I think there was a lot of Irish involved in that one, too. I remember them showing the weapons, which were kitchen knives.
They were attempting to bring resources, too. And the Israeli special forces slaughtered like 10 of them. And that's an important thing to realize about the Gaza siege, is it has been going on I mean, it's a teenager now. It's been going on since 2007. Yeah, it's a pretty horrific situation. Open-air prison is a fair description, and now it's an open-air prison that's being indiscriminately bombed. It really does seem like something out of a dystopian sci-fi film. And for once, and unfortunately, I think this will probably add to the legitimacy of Hamas in some circles. For once, Palestine, the Palestinians have managed to inflict some kind of horror movie retaliation in return. But it's been a long time since there's really been any of that. And certainly it's been half a century since there's been anything on this scale, if ever. So it's incredibly, incredibly grim times, but I do fear like that the supporters of Palestine are relying on sort of a climate of opinion, relying on a sort of decolonial era that's kind of ending. Like the 20th century is ending. The century in which I became an adult is becoming less and less relevant. And I think that story of decolonization and local independence that Palestine relies upon so much for its continued existence and ability to make its opinions felt. I think that may be fading, and that's I think something to pay attention to.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.